Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and we are on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And today, get ready to be inspired. If you think about the things that inspire you most, the people that inspire you most, what qualities do those people have? For me, it is people that are willing to take risk, put it all on the line for something that truly matters to them, to make sacrifices that most people would think are outrageous to make, but they do that because it matters to them. And the other thing that inspires me is when people, well, it's greatness. When people unleash their full potential, if they find a way to do something that most people would say, nah, that's not possible. Well, today on the show, we have Zach Denning and Jeremy Spillman. They are the founders of Hank. Hank is a company that recently was acquired. And Jeremy and Zach will share the story of building the company, taking the risk, making the sacrifices, and figuring it out. And these guys, they had to unleash their full potential in order to get the big W. And it's inspiring when you see people win in a big way. And these two are nothing short of remarkable. So stick around, my friends, and hear the story of Hank, Zach Denning, Jeremy Spillman. Stick around. You know, I have a feeling this is going to be one of the best shows of the year. I am fired up to be welcoming Zach Denning and Jeremy Spillman. They are with Hank, and Hank is this incredible startup. I guess it's not a startup anymore, but they blew up, had a really nice exit. And so we're going to share that story. Zach, you started the company. Give us a little bit of the background, the journey associated with starting it. And then yeah. I know it really started kicking butt when you brought Jeremy on.
Yeah. So I think the joke was always like we had a functioning product, but not a business before Jeremy. So
is he close enough to the mic, Scott? Is he good?
Can you get a little closer?
A little bit closer. Yeah. Just pull up the mic. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, the joke was always that we had a functioning product, but not a functioning business before Jeremy. So we had a few customers, we had a solid proof of concept, but we didn't have something that was scalable.
Yeah.
So we didn't have something that, you know, customer feedback, more customers, target market, ideal customer. You know, we had ideas, but we didn't really have it set in stone.
What made you decide to start the company? What problem were you solving?
Yeah, so I just really didn't like my industry for the most part. So a lot of it was born out of not finding a fit in the industry that I was in.
Yeah. Is that the HVAC world?
Yeah, HVAC controls. And so in HVAC controls, I was a software person in a hardware world. So everybody wanted to talk about hardware and how hardware could improve the industry. And all I wanted to talk about was software. And it was never a software driven industry. So in my mind, I could always drive it to something that was software driving value, not hardware, which is really against the grain for what we're doing.
Yeah, so you guys took software and you're controlling HVAC systems. Mm-hmm. Company does well, especially when Jeremy... Now, what kind of... You know, there's game changers. What prompted you to go find Jeremy?
Yeah, so it's good. In the venture world, it's like single mom, right? And so like most companies don't get venture back to single founder. We went through launch... graduate actually top of the class, but I think that was one of the big things was, you know, the business was always falling off when I wasn't there. So I was the only founder there. And so kind of learned that, you know, you need somebody, you got to start breaking up the rules. And the two big rules are who's going to run ops and who's going to run sales. And you can't do both. And coming out of launch, that was like the big thing for me is I can't do both. I was always okay in sales, but I wasn't the best. I got a few customers sold on the product, but there's no way I could scale it. And so talked with Brandon Brown. Brandon introed me to DJ. DJ's like, hey, I got a friend. That's really
now, these are all guys that have been on the show. DJ was on the show a few months back. Brandon Brown is Grin. He scaled that. And then Launch, just for our audience, is that's Jason Calacanis's accelerator. And he's probably one of the world's most recognized angel investors.
Yeah.
So, okay, Jeremy, you come on board. You're the game. Did you know you were the game changer?
Yeah, I'm still realizing it. I think I'm still trying to figure out if I really am the game changer. But no, I mean, it is funny. Like, you mentioned Brandon Brown, DJ Steph. I mean, those guys are Folsom High class of 03, and look what they've like done in Sacramento. So I stayed real close with DJ. We were actually on vacation together, and he just looks at me and goes, hey, I think I got something you might be interested in. Because I was at another startup that was
it was stirred more down than it was up at the time. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll have a conversation with him. So I met Zach at a Pete's Coffee. We talked for a little bit. Turns out that his dad used to be the CFO at a company that I, you know, started my career at. And I remember just kind of looking at him talking like, this guy is really passionate. He knows what he's talking about. And then at the end, he goes, well, what do you think? I'm like, well, it sounds great. He goes, well, I can't pay you. And that's when I knew, like, you know, maybe he did need a little sales help, because that's not the strongest close to bring somebody on. But no, I mean, it was always... What I'd say is, like, I think that Zach was always able to build that vision. I think that's what made us, like, such great, like, co-founders, was he had the vision go forward. It was, what could you put with him to get that vision out? And I think that's when I was able to come in and see, was like, you know, the way that we're trying to position it right now, nobody's buying, right? There's a reason nobody's buying. And then we just kind of shifted and shifted until he said, hey, we found people that are buying, right? And then you just try to repeat and repeat and repeat. And we're still doing that now. But I'd say that really the only game change that I brought was being able to look at it through a different purview, right? The vision of the product and the company has remained the same, but how we execute and get to that vision and find kind of our way, I think, was what I was able to bring in. And, you know, I would say that, you know, you talk about, like, the having the co-founder, I always give, like, Zach our time. I'm like, I don't know how you were able to, like, last as long, like, without, like, doing, because he was.
You got to be, like, a multitasker. It's not like, you got to be good at a lot of stuff to try to do it alone.
I think, too, you got to have, and I think that's what, again, brought us as far, is, like, you have to have such, like, a singular vision to take, like, all the hardships might be a little over-exaggerating, but to take all the bumps alone, that was what I always, like, kind of really respected about Zach, because when we're together, it's a lot easier. Like, you get punched on the chin, he can push a little bit over to me, I can push a little over to him. Yeah. When you're right there taking that one, it's a lot tougher.
Since you came on board, what's been the biggest punch in the chin? What's been the biggest obstacle you guys have had to overcome?
I mean, COVID right out of the gate. That was crazy.
Oh, that's right.
So we had just started going. We got a little night, you know, we got some investment from the Haney.
I'm a proud investor. Investor, yes.
Exactly. So, and I just remember, like, we got it going, and Zach and I gave this great pitch. We were at the office, and again, you know, shout out DJ Stefan. It set up a pretty nice group for us to go in and pitch to. We got some funding. We got, I would say, like, our first big customer, and then we just started to see the pipeline growing. We've got this pilot. These people are talking to us. And then I remember I came back from, anniversary in March, came back, and then all of a sudden it was like, people are not returning calls. And then all of a sudden, closed down. Right. And as a company that was so reliant on that funding because our revenue numbers weren't there, I just kind of sit back and remember thinking, like, what's going to happen here? This one's going to be interesting. So I would say that one was the hardest one. But I mean, we figured some stuff out during that time, got a little lean, came up with some new product features, and we're really able to drive out of that. And I think that was actually a kind of a key turning point where people started realizing, hey, maybe I need this service more than I used to. Rents aren't going to go up. The commercial, like, real estate has really changed. How am I going to change with it? I think it even made us a little bit, like, more prevalent down the road.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I wonder too, I may have asked you this before, but my dad's name is Hank. And so that's why we invested with you guys, by the way. I miss my dad. So how did you guys come up with the name Hank?
Yeah, that's a good one. Everybody always asks. And they say, like, who's Hank? And I'm like, nobody I know. So it was... We got our first customers over in Roseville, and they were privately owned buildings, so they had suites. And they had some of the suites that were empty. And so we asked them if we could go there and just, like, basically do a pop-up. And so, like, quite literally, like, pop-up tables, pop-up chairs. Took our laptops over there, and we started working. And people would come over because we were controlling the building. And so we had tenants. We told them, hey, it's open door policy. You don't like it, come to us. We're trying to improve the product. These first customers. And so they would come over and they'd say, like, hey, it's actually more comfortable, not less comfortable in our space, more comfortable. This is great. And so we got a lot of good feedback. And somebody came over and said, well, what is it? Like, what are you guys doing? And you can't say, like, oh, we're doing HVAC optimization of building automation systems. They're like, what? You know? And so we started coming up with this idea of virtual engineering. So if you think about, like, the guy in overalls that walks around the ladder, and
right,
hey, I'm too hot and cold, and he pops the ceiling and he adjusts something. Like, it's like that guy. But what you find is, like, 80% of problems in buildings are software, not hardware anymore. So they're just software issues. Somebody didn't set the software up right, it's not working right, or needs to be tuned. And that's why we built the AI, is to tune the software, tune what's going on in the building. And so, like, when we started talking about virtual engineering, like, oh, it's a virtual engineer, what's his name? And so Googled the 10 most trusted names, and Hank was like sixth or something.
Really?
And I was like, Hank is the guy who let him work on my HVAC. Oh, so wow. We'll use that. And so we started calling it Hank.
My dad was a TV appliance repairman. So he was, I didn't know.
House, yeah. You know? I let this guy in my house.
Hank,
you know?
Yeah, got to be good. That's cool. Okay. So thinking about this journey, nobody builds a truly great company alone. Having that co-founder made a big difference. What about having such a high profile investor as Jason Calacanis and some of the other people you brought on? Me? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Was that helpful? I mean, obviously, the Launch Accelerator program is world renowned, but.
Yeah. It's funny, I think, like how the perception of investment, and especially like the first time you go through it. And I would say, like, when I went through an accelerator for the first time, they get you to compete against each other, and I'm really competitive. So I wanted to win. And I would refine my pitch every night. I would get better at it. 3-minute pitches, 2 minutes of questions. And I get really, really good at it. Very streamlined answers, and I did really well at the competing. But I was coming out of it only one of, I think, two companies out of the 10 that didn't get investment. And what you learn is like where your market's at, like what are investor perceptions of your market? And with our market, what we learned is we were getting grouped in with monitoring applications, mm-hmm. which were really prevalent about 5 years before, and they didn't grow. So in the VC world, 100 million or bust, and everybody busted, and there's probably 15 to 20 that busted pretty hard, and they had gotten through A round. And so it was already kind of a bad taste. We were already kind of trying to work ourselves out of a black hole. And I'd say that was very challenging. Coming back locally, we got a lot of support from you and a couple of strong investors here locally, and it was huge. I believed in my vision. I think my vision for the bigger venture community was too soon. I think now it's starting to be more prevalent, but that's 2 or 3 years later.
So any regrets from either one of you guys? Anything you would have done differently?
I don't know. It's tough because I feel like a lot of it seems cliche, but a lot of the mistakes that we made along the way kind of teach you not to repeat that, right? So when people come to me now, it's like the partner stuff on like how we sell, right? We've always been a direct sell. It's very easy to ignore that now because the mistakes that you made at the beginning, you're like, no, not again. I don't know. I mean, it's hard right now because things did end up well, so you don't want to like nitpick along the way. I'm sure there's just because like on the sales side, I'm sure there's a deal that I wish I could have like done a little bit different, tweaked here and there. But I really do feel like every kind of like stub toe that we had just kind of got us to make sure that we missed it next time or are so much more like hyper focused on what we're trying to do. Right. Because there were like a couple deals where we're like, maybe we will just do monitoring. Right. And they didn't go well. Or maybe we will go down this path. And so it's kept us so hyper-focused on here's how we find success. Here's our path. Here's our vision. Here's what our company is. Rather than trying to go out and find partners or fit into this like, square into a circle. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's hard to say any regrets, now. Maybe, I don't know. The acquisition's pretty new, so maybe in a couple months I won't
well,
be as
yeah. Well, I sort of wondered about that. So what went into deciding to take the offer now, take this opportunity now versus like grow it 10 times as big and then take a bigger number? You guys got a great exit, but what if it was 10 times bigger, right? It's kind of like, that's kind of an interesting thing. What goes into the head? You guys are young guys. That's just, get a big payday. What?
It's a hard decision. And it didn't come without a lot of waffling, I would say.
Oh, interesting.
Because like you get, again, going to like the venture route, right? Like that's all you hear about is 10xing and growing and getting huge and make this thing huge. And I'd say that's highly dependent on your market, on what the venture community thinks about you, because you're going to need them long term to scale. You're not going to scale that big without them. You can, it'll take longer. What's your approach? Like how are you going to get to the mass market? For us, I'd say we have a multi-tiered sales process that requires multiple stakeholders to buy in. It can become a longer process and the adoption rates are going to be longer. Is that if we make this exit now, we can kind of get into the belly of the beast and we can expand faster and we can probably expand the vision either as fast or faster with a market leader.
Yeah, you guys got bought by a strategic versus some private equity group or something like that. Somebody who's already in that space. Yeah. Maybe talk to us a little bit about the acquisition and why JLL was the perfect partner.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're twofold. One, they're one of the biggest property management and investment firms in the world. They're worldwide. They have a huge footprint. So they have like a 3 or 4 billion square foot footprint. So it's massive worldwide. They have a ton of infrastructure in place, but then they have JLL Technologies. And so the difference between them and I think a lot of their competitors is they've put a ton of emphasis and a ton of investment in their actual technologies group that operates independently or a little bit separately than the main JLL property management group, with this heavy, heavy focus on pushing technology and becoming almost like the Google of the prop tech space.
Okay.
It's a huge push.
So you got a strategic, and now you guys are staying with the company. And we were kind of talking about that, maybe not joking about the company, but joking about the difference between working in a larger organization and, you know, being a startup.
Yeah, no, it's different. You look at it, it's like Zach and I would, you know, we could get together Friday morning for breakfast and make like 9 massive decisions on what we're doing and where we're going.
Yeah.
Now it's, you've got to have like 9 meetings to make a minor decision. And we're still feeling our way around. I mean, it's a pretty fresh acquisition, you know, beginning of the year. But I would say that it is. It's a different mentality that you have to get into and understand that it's not just the Jeremy and Zach show anymore, right? I've got a boss now, right? I mean, it's different than it used to be. And getting to understand that, I think that would be something that I would say we weren't, I don't want to say surprises, but one of the things that as we got into this, you thought that it would be a little bit more like business as usual, when it has been everything but business as usual.
Oh, interesting. What's been so different? Besides all the decision making, are you folding into one of their divisions?
In a way, yeah, we are. So they've made other acquisitions and they are such ahead. I mean, that was one of the huge things, right? They are investing in technology and making other acquisitions to build out this just offering that nobody else is investing into. So when you look at, you know, going out and truly looking at, okay, I can choose one of the 4 major, you know, commercial real estate companies, JLL has the only one with this technology arm, right? So they're making acquisitions, they're trying to see how, you know, I kind of joke around, it's like, you know, they got a couple dice in the rolling to see how everything shakes out. So I think learning that, you know, you have to be part of not just this, you know, single Hank vision that I've kind of talked about, but understanding how that vision now has to meet at a corporate level. And I think that's been the big change, because before it was like my only focus, the only thing I cared about was like next building, next building, next building. Yeah. And now it's, okay, how do I work with this partner who's going to bring us? And it's just a little bit different.
Zach, on the product side, are they wanting you to integrate your product with other products?
Yeah. So that was, to add on even what Jeremy said, is like JLT is expanding so fast. JLL Technologies Group, JLT, super fast. So the acquisitions that they're making, you have all these new people that are taking over high level roles and trying to get integrated themselves. It feels like Silicon Valley, which is a good and bad. The speed feels like Silicon Valley. So you feel like things can change really fast, but then at the same time, you have all these entities trying to come together, like Jeremy's saying, and feel who's gonna do what? How are we gonna move the ball forward? And you can feel the momentum starting to gain, and we're starting to get there. But trying to get integrated is challenging. And so from a product perspective, yes, is they've made a few big acquisitions pre-Hank, and we're having to figure out with those product teams, what is the product going to look like together? They're being very lenient, I would say. I think everybody's being very lenient. And like, we don't exactly know. You know, we know a few things here and there where we're going to start integrating right now. I think the cool part, though, from my perspective, is like we had planned on fundraising, and they've followed through with their promise of delivering the same amount of capital and support, or even more support, that we would have had, post fundraise. So we built a dev team in 4 weeks that includes 7 people in 4 weeks, and these are high level Silicon Valley full devs.
Nice, nice.
So we built that. We've already started our new Rev2 product after 6 weeks.
Wow.
You never would have gotten that. Had we gone the venture route, we would have had to have recruited and built the team. These are people that already worked together.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And they already worked together in a corporate environment. They were excited to come on board the team. They kind of already knew where our shortcomings were, where the product needed to go. And so they came in excited, knowledgeable, and they're extremely talented. Extremely talented people.
Well, you and I were talking, a month or two ago. It was right after you guys closed the deal. And I think you and your wife were both in a really good mood that night. You were hanging out at an EO party. And but because you guys are living, and I don't know that everybody understands this, but if you are a startup, you know that you live frugally, right? You have to live a frugal lifestyle. And then all of a sudden that changes in a big way. And it puts you in a good mood, obviously. But how did you celebrate?
Yeah. So I think what's interesting, like about our transition, I would say, like financially, was there, it wasn't much, ironically. Okay. And it wasn't much because you stopped caring after a while. You stop caring. Like we were heavily indebted, like as a family, and we knew that like this has to happen. This is an inevitability. Something big will happen, but you already learn to kind of live a little carefree, because like what's your alternative, right? There's no going back for me. Like our mentality was always like there's no industry to go back to. Like I don't want to go back to the industry.
You guys were literally all in.
Yeah. I mean there was no like halfway in the door, and like that's always my piece of advice is like if you're not all in, it probably won't succeed, because there's no going back for us. Like, and we knew that like we were facing like, you know, total destruction if this went down, like financial destruction. I mean, that's
well, what I've about, been around so. A couple, you know, sold a few companies in my time, and here's what I remember. And so I want to kind of contrast your guys' emotions here. So, you know, you're excited because you got the LOI, you got the offer, right? For those listening, it's like you're in escrow on selling a house. You got the offer, and then, you know, there's this due diligence period when, you know, stuff can go sideways kind of easily. And sometimes you're on pins and needles. I know I have. It's been way more. That time is like the most stressful time in the world because, you know, don't mess it up, right, type thing. Is that, did you guys have any of that emotion?
Yeah.
This is not a good time to mess it up.
We had that in spades. Well, I mean, at the time, too, it's like you have to go from, I mean, talk about all in. I mean, because it's basically, you know, we had a team, but I mean, I was running sales. Zach was making sure everything got on right. And then we had to shift our focus over to, it's like you go through like that Death Valley, I think is, you know, what JL referred to it as, because it was all of our efforts getting this acquisition, right? Doing the diligence. I'm, you know, getting all the customer stuff. Zach's putting together the IP. And so much of that just takes your time, since we were such key contributors. That it was one of those things where I just remember thinking like, man, oh man.
Yeah, because if sales stops dipping during, how long was the due diligence period? Like 90 days?
A month.
That's pretty quick.
From end to end, from LOI to the end, we were at like almost 3.5-4 months.
That sounds about right. Yeah. From LOI.
We had to go through and do pilots to prove that the technology worked.
So did you, this is a good lesson for anybody that's selling a company, is that if you take your eye off the ball from a customer standpoint, right, revenue, and you have a dip, that can put the deal at risk. Now, Jeremy, you're the chief revenue officer. Did you guys have a dip? Is that what he said about those? Was that what you were saying about a valley?
I think that, you know, we were able to, like Zach had mentioned those pilots, and, you know, I think that I would say, again, we were fortunate because I think that JLL put a little bit of like a down payment to make sure that like revenue was covered during that time. But there was an absolute dip. If I'm doing outbound and I'm, you know, managing the deal, everything that goes into it. And then all of a sudden it's like, hey, you need to make sure that these buildings go correct. And you're talking to the, you know, same people every day and making sure that these, you know, two projects go perfect to coincide.
It's so easy to take your eye off the ball, especially in a smaller company where, you know, you're not spending your time working on the business. You're in the business when you're an early stage company. With how many employees did you have at the time when you sold?
Six
employees. Yeah. So there goes, you know, pretty big piece of the workforce is running reports for the buyer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was that okay? So as you started seeing that happen, walk me through the emotion of that 90 days.
Because to me, the highs were high, the lows were low.
Every day. And like everybody always says, like things will go wrong. It's about persistency. And like, well, we know how to be persistent, but it's like, how do things go wrong? Like how things can't go wrong. This is just, you know, we got everything lined up. You know, the one of the pilots went off really well and kind of solidified the deal that we did. And then you see all the other stuff that has to happen for a deal to get made. And you just don't understand how many steps there are. It's like, oh, just the next step will be it. And you get to that step and it's just like false peaks.
And you guys didn't have an investment bank or anything. You were negotiating it for yourself. They were dealing directly with you.
Yeah, very, very lucky that my dad was on board.
Oh, Mark. Yeah, Mark Denning. He's a CFO, outsourced CFO type guy.
He does a lot of acquisitions.
So he does.
He does the financial aspect of acquisitions. And so of the workload, I'd say he handled a significant.
Anybody who's selling a company, anybody who has a company, but if you're selling a company, you need like a deal team, and there needs to be a stud in the finance side for all that. So you had your dad.
So I had my dad. So, and he's financially incentivized. You know, he was the first angel that got in and that believed, and, you know, really it was him and me for the first, you know, year or two while we built the product and just got it off the ground, you know, both financially and operationally. So he knew a lot about the business. So it was fantastic to have him there. You realize like how much accounting ties together these deals is a mess.
But also having somebody that, to me, this is interesting because if you haven't sold a company before, you know, you guys, Jeremy, have you sold a company before? Yeah. So you guys are in the heat of it and it's high stress, high stakes. To have a guy like your dad, been there, done that. Yeah. A little bit older, you get that calming influence. I'm sure. Yeah. Sure, well, I assume he was a calming influence.
Yeah, he took the highs, made him a little bit less high, and took the lows, made him a little less low.
Yeah, yeah. Dads can do that. Yeah.
There's no way that, like, 100% what you said. You have to have somebody who's tying this all together, right? There, I don't think the deal would have happened without Mark. We probably had more of an advanced bookkeeping, accounting than even JLL was probably prepared for. They thought it was just going to be Zach's
bunch of receipts.
I got a shoebox. Does that help?
Yeah, it's like a big wallet from Seinfeld where we keep all of our invoices. And what George had. I really do think that was key. And then two, Zach and I never sold the company, right? Like I sell software. He implements it. So to have somebody who can understand the intricacies of what goes into the deal and what they're asking for, and even terms, because in these meetings, I remember Zach and I would just be Googling, they bring something up and we're hitting Google trying to follow it, and Mark's already taken the lead on it. But again, I really do stand by that. I just do not see it would have happened. Well, maybe it would not have happened in the time frame or the current structure that we got without Mark.
Yeah. Was there anybody else that was key to the exit? Sometimes an attorney can play an important role.
Yeah, we had a team. So there was a few local guys here, and then they brought in a few big hitters from Silicon Valley, and so we built the team, and it was good. I think the really interesting thing is, one of the attorneys that we had in Silicon Valley, he would show you when you're negotiating different parts of the deal, he'd show you what percentage you should fall in. If they want to negotiate this, how many years out for deferral or something? Well, the normal is 2, and here's your percentage of people that go 3, 4, and 5. So when you're negotiating on topics you have no idea to negotiate about,
right?
And you're thinking this could hurt me if I didn't negotiate it right. He's telling you how to negotiate. And in some of those instances, it was the pushback was, well, why am I unique? When they came back and said, oh, it needs to be, this X deferral, and you go, well, why am I unique? And it's I'm not, so I should be around here.
You're against, if you're selling a company, especially to someone that's got, that's an experienced acquirer, these guys are great negotiators, right? Mm-hmm. You're against people who really know what they're doing, and they're going to ask for more. Mm-hmm. And I think, as a software guy or as a sales guy, all the terminology, all that kind of stuff, and it can be kind of overwhelming.
Yeah, and that's where I think the good thing about having a strong attorney is somebody that can explain it to you. Here's what happens if it's great, here's what happens if it's bad, and here's the risk of what they're asking. And then here's what the norm of what they should be asking. Then as long as you're okay negotiating, then you have a bounds or a basis of negotiation, then you can go back and have a good negotiation. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that you need to know everything. It just needs to be, you need to be forthright, and you need to be comfortable standing your ground. And I think those are the two things that I really had to learn quick was, we're going to hold our ground here, but we're going
to
shift here.
Did you have to be sort of willing to have the deal fall apart, right? When you stand your ground, that means, hey, deal could fall apart?
It could.
Yeah.
And so I think like any deal, though, it's about finding middle ground. It wouldn't just hurt me if it fell apart. It would hurt them too. They're in this for 3 or 4 months, just like we are. They're in this, like Jeremy said, financially the same way we are. This is a push from the top that what we're doing is going to be a part of their organization long term, and it's going to be integral. And so I think that'd be kind of our North Star every time is what if this part falls apart? Falls apart for them too.
Yeah. Nickel and diamond over some terms, right? The economics are pretty much set. And then the terms, you know that they want you at that point.
Yeah.
Right. They're offering enough money where you guys want us. Come on now.
Yeah. And I think that has to be North Star is there's got to be common ground for some things. And that's where even we push back. And that was the other thing is pushing back against your own attorney and saying we need to get it done. And we're okay with this sacrifice.
Okay.
And then every time you did that, what you'd see across the table is if you guys are okay with that sacrifice, we'll be okay with this one. And you'd see that push and pull. And again, it's like if somebody wants something bad enough, it's not just us wanting the acquisition, it's them wanting this as a long-term play for their business, then you're just trying to find how much do I push and how much do I pull. But I don't think it's at any point it was inseparable, right? It's this isn't going to work. We probably would have figured that out in the first, I'd say, 1 or 2 months. After signing the LOI, I think we would have figured out this just isn't a fit. But once you figure out it's a fit, the pilot's a success, this is something they want, then it's just a matter of finding the middle ground.
Okay. What else should we talk about? I mean, this to me is like, what was the first thing you went out and bought afterwards? You buy a house, buy your wife, you know.
I don't think my wife stopped buying things. Is that a fair statement? Like, she just had the most extravagant 30th birthday that I could ever imagine. But
that's awesome.
Yeah, you know, I think that's what is that I would say that like Zach and I, why we've had success is that it wasn't ever like, it's not about like the first thing that we're buying. It's nice to be comfortable. There's no line there. It's nice to pick up a bar tab, nice to pick up a dinner tab. But like in all reality, I feel like we feel like our work still is ahead of us in a lot of ways, right? We truly believe in like what we're doing, what we want to build, and like we're also workers too. Like I like working. Like I like going in, I like selling stuff, I like doing this. And now like even with the new challenges that we get, you kind of like going over those as well. So you know, it's not so much for me, at least. I mean, like I said, my wife, I'm sure, has a completely different opinion as she remodels our backyard and you know, is leasing new cars. But for me, I think it's just kind of like, you know, we got a lot of work ahead of us still.
Yeah,
like,
new goals, huh?
Well, I think that's what keeps you going too, right? If you ever stop like putting out those new goals of what you want to do,
you have to. If you're not growing, you're dying. That's the way I look at it. Okay, so how about for you?
I think it's
you buy anything?
Jeremy's right. Like when you're in, it's always, you always imagine like, oh, I'm gonna get this and I'm gonna get that. And now it's just like on to the next thing. I think we took like a day off after the first. They gave us the weekend of the first. We got Monday off, and that was the day we took off.
The first,
the first of this year.
So we got bought on the 30th.
We got brought on the 30th.
30th of December. Okay.
And we were back to work by the 2nd.
Yeah.
So
wow.
Like Jeremy and I are, I'd say like hyper competitive. We don't like
I'm
to
way
lose.
More
competitive. We don't like to lose, and so like it was like this is instantly like the next goal. To me, this was I wanted to fundraise. I wanted to either grow through fundraising or I wanted to grow through acquisition. But this is that was a stepping stone in that process. And like, I got a car, you know, we got an offer accepted on a house. But to me, it's like the focus is still the business. It's nice to have those things. But like,
what kind of car did you get?
I got a 69 Falcon.
Oh, vintage, huh? Why that one?
It's hand built. So the guy built it from scratch. And so it's hard to pass.
That's awesome.
But it's like, to me, the focus, like I don't think we ever broke focus on like it's still the business. Yeah. Like these things are like nice to have. They weren't like a stopping point by any means. Yeah. And it wasn't like the ultimate goal. Like the goal is still to grow this as much as humanly possible.
That's cool.
Maybe we'll celebrate like at the end of each year. We'll do something.
We did a company party.
But that was probably first. Something that you and I should get better at is
celebrating victories.
We don't celebrate small wins very well, I don't think.
We don't do a great job of that. I got some advice to kind of like, and we did like the night that we signed, you know, we were, all
that's
the guys
true.
Got together.
We were also tired.
That was one of the things too, because it's like it was literally right after Christmas. Like you got all your family and thought you're doing all this. And it had been, I don't want to say touch and go, but there had been a couple things where we thought, okay, is this going to get pushed? And if it does get pushed next year, how high of a priority is? Does it move around? So I don't know. I would say that should be something that you and I improve on is, you know, celebrate maybe a little bit more. Yeah, because it's...
Yeah, you closed last year, and there was, I think, if I remember correctly, there was concern at that point that capital gains rates were going to increase and some kind of stuff like, hopefully it doesn't happen now, but, you know, I remember thinking that too. It's like, oh, shoot, capital gains could tick up.
Yeah,
but,
it was a big push. It was a big push towards the end of getting it closed. You know, we'd always set out to get it closed prior to December, and, you know, the more it pushed and pushed, and I say that was like one of the big, like we gave a little bit. Because JLL decided to work their whole staff through the holidays.
Okay.
So everybody worked. We didn't take a holiday. So I had no Christmas. We were literally getting docs prepped Christmas Eve. So while we wrapped packages, my wife and I had the computer in the lap and, you know, packages on one side, computer on the other, and we were reviewing docs.
Yeah. And at that point, you know it's going to close. Now it's just hurry up.
Now it's just timeline. It's getting it closed. And I remember we got it closed officially like 2 or 3 days before the end of the year.
Wow.
Which was intense.
So advice to the next person in line, we've got a few minutes left, but I want to make sure that, you know, you guys have a chance to help that next person. No matter, we're all at different stages in our life, but, you're in, is my buddy Tom Kandris. I don't know if you guys know him or not. He says you're breathing rarefied air, right? You guys are one of the few that know what it's like to do what you've done. A lot of people don't know what you know, right? And it probably hasn't even sunk in yet, but you are like, you know, an oddity in many ways with how fast you guys grew that and the, you know, the success that you had, the numbers you got. So we want to know, like, well, we got to get into your head. So any thoughts on, you know, to other entrepreneurs?
Yeah, I'd say I have a few. So one, figure out what you're not good at and find somebody that can do it. Absolutely. So I was not good at selling the product and trying to do ops. I was okay at selling it, and I was really good at ops. So if I had found Jeremy 2 years earlier, we probably would have moved twice as fast. So in that instance, may have gotten to the market faster, may have found our problems faster. The business would have moved faster. So I'd say that's number one, is like, be okay not being good at everything. And when you aren't good at something, just find somebody that is, bring them in, incentivize them. The second thing is like, never be comfortable. Like, I was never in a spot where I was comfortable. I was, it was my dad and me, it was our money, mostly his, which was his retirement. So there's never like a comfortability. Every day I was burning my parents' retirement out. Oh, that's a pretty good incentive to not screw up. So there was no out. There was no like, hey, I can go do this for a while and come back. It was this full time and I had to make it work. And so those were the two things. Like that was my motivation, was I can't fail, quite literally. And then the length of time could have been shortened had I found, you know, Jeremy faster and just chalked it up as like, you know, don't focus on sales, find somebody that can help you.
Yeah. Jeremy?
Yeah, I think my thing is, like, one of my favorite quotes of all time is, like, Sam Walton, when they asked him, like, how Walmart did well, he's all, well, we got after it, we stayed after it. So I think for me, it's just, like, just keep going. As many times as, like, you know, Zach and I had said, where we had to take a couple things on the chin, I think it was always, like, when he was, like, all in, that's kind of where I think I'm getting at, is, like, just keep going. Like, don't let the speed bump stop you. Don't let any of this stuff go. It's, like, we changed our product 5 times. We changed our client 5 times. We changed what we're, you know, what we are, who we're serving so many times. But we knew we had something. We were just able to stay on that and keep going and going. And, I mean, I think that, you know, like you said, any good success story, nobody was just like, oh, here's a product and, you know, everybody bought it and it worked out for it. It just doesn't happen, right? It's just getting through that. And it's like, how are you going to continue? And I think that was one of like the biggest keys to our success. Like, just, we just never stopped. We just kept going. We kept going. We kept going. And I think that's what, you know, kind of got us to where we are. And it's what we're going to keep doing as well.
Well, congratulations. You're definitely a true Sacramento success story. You're one of these people that could have taken their company to the Bay Area. You kept it here in our region. And provided a lot of opportunity for us in the investment community. But I mean, that success to me, it breeds future success for others. People are going to be inspired when they hear this show, and they're going to be like, those guys seem like great guys, solid advice. Maybe I should go for it too. So thank you guys for being willing to sort of share openly and in a human way what it's like to have some really kick-ass success. That is, it's inspiring for me too as the old guy. That's why I love doing this, get to be around guys like you and live vicariously through you guys. So thank you very much. Welcome back to the Mark Haney Show. And I think you were likely inspired. I know I was, as I hear the stories of winning. It's always so. That's why we started the show, is to educate, to inspire. So today was a little bit educational, but it was definitely inspirational. These guys take risks, make sacrifices. Zach and Jeremy did something incredible when it comes to building Hank, and it happened right here in our hometown. And I'm going to do a little throwback moment for us today. I'm going to go back 10 years ago this week, when I was inspired by a different group of people. It was 10 years ago this week when I was really nervous. I had the opportunity to give what I felt was the most important speech of my life. And so I was nervous. It was like, I wanted to make it so that I was sending a team out to perform, and this team was a group of United States Marines the day before they were deploying to Afghanistan. And this particular group of Marines were going to the most dangerous place in the world at that time. As some of you may know, that Sangin, Afghanistan was where so many of our young people were killed and brutally wounded over the years in that fight in Afghanistan. And but I was fortunate enough to rent out a restaurant and host a group of Marines, their family members, and because I had rented out the restaurant and I was buying dinner, I felt it only fitting that I say some opening remarks. And so, what do you say? And this is why I was nervous. What do you say when you know it's the pregame speech, sending a group of Marines off to fight? So as you hear this, this is real world stuff. I think most people have probably never even contemplated the opportunity to give a speech, like you're going to hear. The audio is a little rough, so bear through it. You may need to turn it up a little bit, but my wife, I think, recorded it on her phone back 10 years ago this week. So the story of these guys going off to the most dangerous place on Earth, it didn't happen that night. We partied that night. We had a good time. It was a little raucous. The next morning, it was the most humbling moment of my life, because these guys the next morning got up early, got their gear together, got their weapons together, and they were getting ready to ship off on buses to get on an aircraft carrier and fly to Afghanistan. And as I watched these young men, these heroes, taking this challenge so seriously, it was a different experience than the night before, where we were kind of partying. This day was solemn. This day was somber in mood. There were tears among all the family members that were watching their loved ones pull away in the bus. I looked at the bus, and there was one guy hanging out the bus that didn't seem like any of the rest. And he was hanging out the window, just like fired up, still ready to go kick some butt, I guess, or he hadn't changed into that somber mood yet. And that was my son, Marcus. It was funny then thinking back on it. But I can tell you that at that moment, he's hanging out the window, pumping his fist, the buses pull away, and I look around, and I think the reason it was so humbling is because I looked around the family and the friends that were there in this parking lot, and it was like, I'm back here with the women and children. Why, the real men are going off to fight. I'm back with the women and children while the real men are going off to fight. And It was a really interesting set of months. My son ended up coming back in June. This was in March. He ended up coming back in June. I'm sure I'll share what happened, the rest of the story, in June, if we can make time for it. But I bring this up on an entrepreneurial show because one of the things that goes through my mind when I see people making these kind of sacrifices, I think to myself, what can I do? Right? What can I do? While the real men are going out to the fight, what can I do? And we've transferred what we can do into our charitable organization, Allegiant Giving, where we help veterans return back into civilian life. We do some great things, but also for entrepreneurs, right? Entrepreneurs make incredible sacrifices. They take risks in order to change the world. And, you know, they're the heroes of the American economy. So for all of you out there fighting the good fight, for our freedom, for our security, and our way of life, and to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship, trying to change the world in some way, you know, you might probably say to yourself, what can I do? What can we do? Well, I want you to know something, you know. At the Growth Factory and at Haney Biz, you know, we salute you. We salute the flag, the 13 stripes, and the 50 stars. We salute that American dream that's always worth fighting for, yours. We're never above you. We're never below you. We're always by your side.
Treadmill.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.